in to People's Tribune Radio. I'm Kenny Shook. On this edition of PTR, we complete our two-part series of the opening plenary to the Food, Global Justice, and Corporate Power, Reclaiming Our Farms, Forests, and Future teach-in, which was held in June 2003 at Cal State University, Sacramento.
Let me make this clear. Industry activists are wrong. Genetically modification through transgenesis is substantially different from anything the evolution of plants have seen. It has nothing to do with the crossing of normal plants with other plants and with wild relatives and so on, which is traditional breeding. The movement of genes across species boundaries is something unprecedented. And we don't really know what we're doing. We do not have control over it. It moves by itself. It's not like any chemical or oil spill that you can control. It is a pollution that moves by itself, that reproduces, and we have found it even to the most remote corners of the globe.
People's Tribune Radio is produced by the League of Revolutionaries for a New America, who also publishes the newspaper People's Tribune, Tribuno del Pueblo. Contact and ordering information will be available at the end of the program. We continue with the opening plenary, hearing from Luke Anderson of the Genetic Engineering Action Network.
We have Dr. Ignacio Chapella from the Department of Environmental Science, Policy and Management from UC Berkeley, a scientist who's had direct experience of offending corporate interests when it comes to revealing nasty truths about genetic engineering. Ignacio Chapella.
Thank you. It really is a great honor to be here. Before I start, I really want to make you note, people in front, how many people are back there. It's really incredible to see how many of you are here, how active you are. And my hat really tips to you for upholding the light of reason and for standing up for democracy in the face of incredible intimidation. What happened this morning here with the seeds happened also in St. Louis when we also tried to have a conference. People going to the conference were picked up by police and put in jail for no reason whatsoever, you know, taken off their bikes and so on. So I really tip my hat off to you for being here and standing up in the face of this intimidation that continues to grow and grow. You're in a real sense heroes. I work in the crown jewel of the University of California system, and with all excuses to people at Davis, the university system in an agricultural state that represents probably the sixth or seventh economy in the world, based mostly in the economy. So I work in the place where the thinking, the strategizing for how agriculture should develop for the world is done. An infamous but very influential dean in my college, the College of Natural Resources, is known to have gone to the Central Valley and talked to farmers and let them know that we are working at Berkeley on ways of doing agriculture without soil. That we're looking forward to the day when we can grow our food without soil. I'm sure many of you can see that's absolutely crazy, but Sylvia already noted that we're also looking forward to the day, or some people there are looking forward to the day when agriculture can be done without people. And they better do. They better do, because the way agriculture is going, not only in this country, but mostly in this country, is really bad. We have now the equivalent of the ozone hole, the biological equivalent of the ozone hole, right here at home, in the mouth of the Mississippi. If you know, you can go there every summer and you will find death in a volume that, in an area that is the size, some people say, Rhode Island. It changes from year to year, just like the ozone hole. And this is the result of a bankrupt, biologically bankrupt agricultural system. Don't get me wrong. The agricultural system that was brought by a set of technologies and luck that we call the Green Revolution made great inroads into increasing yield, into providing more food in the end, at a major environmental cost. So we mortgaged our environment, we mortgaged our people, we mortgaged a way of life, whole sociologies, for the benefit of a bump increase in yield. Now it was time to face the consequences of that mortgage, to pay the debt. Instead of that, we are being invited to buy into another mortgage, buy a second mortgage in the biotech or so-called biotech revolution. There are several problems with it, though. First of all, the biotech revolution is not the green revolution. There is nothing compared to the yield associated with green revolution technologies in the biotech revolution. So this technology, as also Peter said, is leading to bankrupt companies. So we are having really serious debt problems, actually just physically, not only environmentally and socially. And we're having problems also with a technology that is totally out of control. Let me make this clear. Industry activists are wrong. Genetically modification through transgenesis is substantially different from anything the evolution of plants have seen. It has nothing to do with the crossing of normal plants with other plants and with wild relatives and so on, which is traditional breeding. The movement of genes across species boundaries is something unprecedented. And we don't really know what we're doing. We do not have control over it. It moves by itself. It's not like any chemical or oil spill that you can control. It is a pollution that moves by itself, that reproduces, and we have found it even to the most remote corners of the globe. So they are wrong. Industrial activists are wrong on that. They are right, industrial activists, on some other things, though. For example, they will tell you that the seeds that they are producing contain culture, contain the technology, they call it, itself. They do. They say, you don't need to train anybody. You just give them the seeds, and something comes in this seed that will do the trick. So you don't need to train them. You don't even need to inform them about it. But what is it? What is it that these seeds carry? Well, what these seeds carry is two things mostly: ownership and risk. So when I talk to especially Latin American officials, and they say, you know, we're really concerned about this, but we cannot afford to not jump on the bandwagon. We need to access this technology. I reply, you're not accessing technology. You would access technology if you took me back to Mexico, where I come from, and I cannot find a job. You know, it was easier for me to find a job at Berkeley than back at home. You would access technology that way. What you're accessing here is risk by the ton, risk by the shipful. Why is it risky? Mostly because of this tampering, this unprecedented tampering with the genomic composition, the genomic choreography of the cell, of the organism. There is a resistance, there is a conservativeness in the biology of the cell, in the genome, in the chromosome structure, that is broken by transgenesis. So we are broken that genomics of resistance by the introduction of these seeds. Okay? And this invasion of the genomics, of the choreography of the cell, moves by itself, is spilled into the environment. So it becomes also an assault on the ecology of these environments where we are releasing these seeds. We are breaking ecologies of resistance. Environments tend to be conservative. Environments want to be, ecosystems want to be what they are, just like cells, just like you want to be what you are, and you don't want to become a bacterium. That's why you don't like to have DNA from a bacterium in your cells. Ecologists don't like to have foreign DNA and foreign organisms. So we are violating ecologies of resistance, and we are violating sociologies of resistance through the introduction of these seeds, through the release of these organisms. Well, who cares? Because we're looking forward to the day when we are going to be able to grow our food without people, so we don't need their sociology. We look forward to the day when we can grow food without soil, so we don't need their ecology, right? Well, wrong. Just go to the mouth of the Mississippi again, and you will find what lies ahead if we continue going this way. These sociologies, these ecologies will be needed. The germplasm that is being eroded through genetic pollution right now in the global south will be needed if we are to maintain a sustainable world and if we are to keep growing our food altogether. not only beautifully, not only nicely. If we are to eat, we need to have these resources, these sociologies, these ecologies, these genomes. So I invite you to confront this invitation, this enticement into going into the new, the double green revolution, the blue revolution, not necessarily because of who is doing it, but because in the maintenance of those ecologies and those sociologies lies the future of our very survival. I invite you also to go to go with that light of reason in your hand. Science is needed. This is not about opposing science. This is not about necessarily opposing technology. Science is needed, but we are applying the wrong type of science. We are not bringing in evolution. We are not bringing in ecology into this. When industry activists talk about scientific testing of these crops, they go and test them chemically. But that's not what we're talking about. We need to do the right science, and we, all of us here, need to push. We need to push regulatory agencies, we need to push governments, and we need to push international agencies and multilateral bodies to put the right science in the place and put all of us on the driver's seat that we have been denied. Thank you.
I'm Kenny Shook. This is People's Tribune Radio. You are listening to the opening session of a biotechnology and genetic engineering teach-in, which was held at California State University in Sacramento, moderated by Luke Anderson.
And next, we're very fortunate to have Drina Nyirenda from the Program Against Malnutrition in Zambia.
To start with, I wish to greet you all and to thank you for coming to listen to us. And I also thank those who supported me, the Friends of the Earth, to come this far from Zambia. What I'm going to present to you is a case study. Zambia last year was faced with a food crisis that saw one quarter of its population without food, and mainly because of the drought that happened the previous year. However, during this food crisis, we discovered that the food that was coming in was GM maize. And that was discovered at a press conference when a reporter asked, and then we were told that actually the food that's coming in is GM food. The country does have phytosanitary regulations, which regulate against entry of GM products in the country, and however, these were not followed. As a result, the government rejected the food and asked the World Food Program to remove the food, and my organization, Program Against Malnutrition, our mandate, we work to in food distribution, relief food distribution to affected areas, as well as we provide recovery mechanisms for drought affected areas. So we are an agricultural organization that provides support to small scale farmers to produce their own food, especially after a disaster like what happened last year. So we did stand by government's position to refuse that food, and mainly because there were major concerns, some of which have been just illustrated here. The first concern for us was one of the environmental effects, particularly on the local crops that we grow. Our farmers, 80% of the food that's produced in Zambia is produced by small-scale farmers, and these use open pollinated varieties of maize. We have a large variety of other seed crops, sorghums and millets. So all these crops, what would happen to them if these hunger-prone places, you know, these people had lost all their crop. So all they were going to get is this GM maize which had come in. And traditionally, when a farmer is given any crop, the first thing they think of is seed. So most of them were going to reserve some of this maize and plant it as seed. So what was going to happen to our local varieties of maize? That was a major concern for us as well as government. Secondly, it was a health concern. The Zambian staple of food, which is maize, we consume 70 to 90% of the calories a day from this very one food, which meant that these people that were affected by the hunger were going to be eating on a daily basis 70 to 90% of their calories from this GM food. And to start with, most of them, they were already in poor nutrition condition because of the hunger. Secondly, we have HIV/AIDS, which affects about 19% of the population. So already their nutrition is worsened by poor health. So what would be the implications of eating so much GM food for a period of 9 months until the next harvest? So to us, that was a major concern. So essentially, we did propose, amidst the whole chaos of there is no non-GM food, we proposed to WFP that we can mobilize cassava. One third of the population in Zambia consumes cassava as a staple food. And in the areas where cassava is produced, there was no hunger. Actually, they had a surplus of cassava. So we proposed to them to purchase this cassava and redistribute it to the affected areas. Unfortunately, it was not part of their mandate to purchase locally. So that was not accepted. But eventually, some food did come from the same WFP, although it was not as much as was targeted. Only 50% of the food that was required finally was distributed in the country. I think, how did we survive? Because we only got 50%. I think really what happened was there was an underestimation of the normal, natural coping mechanisms of the rural people. They used a lot of forestry reserve, you know, resources. People looked for wild fruits, wild plants, and also the extended family system. You know, if you had a family way out in the rural areas, you made sure you sent them something to make sure that they didn't die. And also government bought a lot of maize from the surplus areas where the cassava grows, which we assume the people who eat cassava decided to sell their maize, and they ate the cassava themselves. So that, in a way, also assisted to avert the hunger. But the issue really here is what are the real causes of food insecurity in Zambia? In Zambia, droughts and floods always happen. We know one will come 3-4 years later, and they are expected. And I don't think they are really the major cause. There are many other things that cause our food insecurity. Among them is the lack of support for the small-scale farmers. Since we embraced liberalization in 1991, and we accepted IMF, World Bank conditions for liberalization, which included removal of any support to the agriculture system or to any system at all, our small-scale farmer production went down, and it has always gone down because they cannot afford to purchase improved seed. They cannot afford to purchase fertilizer if they are growing maize or any other inputs or technologies, you know, for plowing, you know, plows and things like that. They can't afford them. And most of the small-scale farmers used to own animals. They've sold all that because of trying to access production inputs for them to produce more food. So we feel that really the issues of support to the small-scale farmer are paramount. Because last year, after this disaster, government decided to support the small-scale farmers and distributed inputs to 300,000 small-scale farmers. And my program was one of those that distributed to 128,000 small-scale farmers. Seed packets, fertilizer for those who did maize, sorghums, millets, cassava, sweet potatoes, a diversity of crops so that if one failed, they would have something still to eat. And this year, the result is that we have a bumper crop. We have produced double what we had last year. And that's only counting maize, excluding the sorghums that have been produced, the millets, the cassava, and the sweet potatoes. So you can see that alternative technologies do exist. And we think that using these conventional technologies and giving the farmers support to produce, we can feed ourselves. And this is a major source of employment for our farmers. Everyone is not, you know, unemployment in Zambia is like 90%. So you depend on the land to employ yourself. So I really came here to share this with you so that you can give us support. Because what we really need is some of these inflexible rules that are given to third world countries where you are told in order to do well, to get a loan from IMF, you should not give support to your own small-scale farmers. They are very unfair. But with your support, we think that we can do well.
That concludes the opening session of the Food, Global Justice, and Corporate Power teach-in, which was held at California State University in Sacramento. This event was held in response to the International Biotechnology Ministerial, which was being held at the same time in Sacramento. PTR correspondent Mike Thornton was at the press conference and provides the following responses from Ann Veneman, U.S. Secretary of Agriculture, and David Kervalesi, Georgia's Minister of Food and Ag. These responses reveal contradictions depicting the U.S.-sponsored event to be more about biotech advancements than feeding the world's hungry.
I attended a press conference held by U.S. Secretary of Agriculture Ann Veneman and several of the ministers who spoke at the Biotechnology Expo. Many people who are outside of this building today are saying that the goal of alleviating hunger that's being stated in here is a sham, and that what this conference is really about is shoving a dangerous technology, genetic engineering, down the throat of the world and turning control of the world's food supply over to private corporations. Why are they wrong? Specifically, why are they wrong?
This is a conference about global hunger. It is a conference that is discussing a broad range of technologies, some of them very simple technologies. Biotechnology is one of the various technologies that we're discussing in this conference, but certainly not the only one. I gave several examples, I believe, in my opening remarks today about various conservation practices that have increased the maize productivity by 46% in just 5 years in the country of Uganda. Technology, just in terms of how potatoes are planted on hillsides, increasing productivity by 70%. These are subsistence crops in these countries. And this is the kind of technology that we are talking about in addition to a broad range of technologies. And I think that what we're seeing from this conference is the coming together of many people to learn. I saw on so many of the ministers, particularly from the developing world, very interested in the comments today of Dr. Caldwell, who's had so much experience with these array of technologies, the importance of genomic sequencing to be able to see what kinds of issues cause diseases. She showed the example of the potato blight that caused the famine in Ireland and how you can address some of these issues for the future. And that's really what this conference is about. And I might ask my colleagues here to comment.
David Kervalesi is the Minister for Food and Agriculture in the country of Georgia, formerly part of the Soviet Union.
I cannot tell you that they are wrong. The point is that I think the little slightly misunderstanding of the meeting what we are doing today here. Since the difference exists in opinions, that's why it was decided, and I'm really thankful to Secretary Venom and the all USDA team that they invited us here to speak about. And I can tell you frankly that I'm ready right now to speak all those 5,000 persons separately, because it's an issue that I also would like to have full and complete information about. Main problem here that we are facing is awareness, what's going on in the world in this matter. And it's just up to the many developments that many of us probably completely we do not understand in details. But the problem is that we need to continue this matter, intensive dialogue, together with scientists. We need to take example from the nature. Nature also makes too many things in biotechnology. That is what we need to learn. And that's why science exists. Everything, action, just thing in the world, that it has two borders, left and right, it is resistance borders. If we humans can perform within that, so it's affordable. If we just exaggerate it, make even a little bit too much, the irreversible changes will take place. So I think the main importance is to find this right place where we can act, because we need to work, but we need to learn from the nature, and nobody, I think, denies the importance of that. Unfortunately, this case with, regarding the Canada that I heard, I agree with colleagues that it's a legal issue, but what to do, just to stop on that? I think it's better to continue working, to continue dialogue, to speaking with all of us, invite scientists. And I would like to tell you that 1 week ago, there used to be a very important conference in Rome, held by purely scientific conference, all ecological scientists there discussing the importance of the future of the biotechnology, the problems, the bottlenecks, and the possibilities way to cooperate in the future.
Genetically modified food and biotechnology is becoming an ever more important aspect to the lives of populations around the world. While millions of starving and vulnerable people have been offered assistance from the biotech industry, the industry's interest is not in serving the needs of the people. Rather, they would like to experiment with the production of such crops in order to make profit at the expense of poor people and consumers. In order to truly advance agriculture through biotechnology, it must be done in the interest of all people, not only wealthy corporations and government leaders. That's it for PTR. People's Tribune Radio has been brought to you by the League of Revolutionaries for a New America. The League advocates for a cooperative society, where the same science and technology being used for private enterprise is shared in the interest of all of humanity. If you would like to contact the League for a copy of the program or other print and media resources, you can do so by calling the 800 number, 1-800-691-6888. That's 1-800-691-6888. By calling this number, you can also receive information on the League's Speakers Bureau. You can also visit us on the internet at www.lrna.org. I'm Kenny Shook, and on behalf of the League of Revolutionaries for a New America, we hope you join us next time for another edition of People's Tribune Radio.